Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. And we are thrilled to have our latest supporter on board, Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by a gift from Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a great pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Conder and Dr. Alana Conder at Carolina Neuropsychological Service in Raleigh. They specialize in assessing and treating brain disorders. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. As regular Radio In Vivo listeners will know, we cover the genetics and genomics beat frequently on the show, as there is so much going on here in the Triangle at the cutting edge of those scientific pursuits. Today's show falls right into that line as we discuss the scientific, ethical, legal, and social aspects of the genetic and genomic screening of newborn infants. As is so often the case, the awarding of a large NIH grant is what brought me to my guest today, Dr. Cynthia Powell of UNC Chapel Hill. Along with her colleague, Dr. Jonathan Berg from the Leinberger Cancer Center, she will co-administer a five-year, $5 million grant from the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development and the National Human Genome Research Institute, both of which are parts of the National Institutes of Health, or NIH. Under the grant, which was awarded in September of 2013, the UNC team will sequence the entire genomes of 400 newborns to help determine what useful clinical data can be acquired through the tests. Dr. Cynthia Powell is a professor of pediatrics and genetics and chief of the Division of Genetics and Metabolism in the Department of Pediatrics at the UNC School of Medicine. She is also medical director of the Cytogenetics Laboratory at UNC Hospitals and director of the Medical Genetics Residency Program. She received her undergraduate degree from Cornell, her master's in human genetics from Sarah Lawrence, and her medical degree from the Medical College of Virginia. She completed her pediatric residency at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., where she also did a fellowship in medical genetics in a combined program with the NIH. She is board certified in pediatrics, clinical genetics, cytogenetics, and genetic counseling. Cindy is also an investigator in the Carolina Center for Genome Sciences, where so much highly innovative research is being practiced. Cindy, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you, Ernie. Thank you for the invitation.
I'd like to start our discussion today by having you provide our listeners with a bit of an overview of the field at this point, which has been progressing so rapidly and making such enormous strides. Tell us a bit about whole genome sequencing and about whole exome sequencing, which seems to be coming into vogue for certain applications as the science moves forward.
Sure. So traditionally, we've been able to look at large chunks of people's genomes through cytogenetics, an area that I work in. And this would give us an idea, for example, if someone had an additional chromosome, such as a person with Down syndrome, for example, who has an extra chromosome number 21. That was a fairly crude way, one could say, to look at the whole genome of a person, but it was the best we could do with the technology that we had available beginning around the 1960s, where we first started doing this widely. Mm-hmm. As things progressed, we were able to look at smaller and smaller missing pieces or extra pieces of DNA through other technology, such as a technique called fluorescence in situ hybridization, which uses probes. But you have to know that technology is termed abbreviated FISH.
Right.
And what I always say is, you know, you have to know where to fish in order to really, you know, be able to figure out if something's missing or extra.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years ago or so, we started widespread use of something called a microarray technology, which again was a way to look for extra or missing pieces of a genetic material in an individual. But it still didn't get us down to the level of really the single nucleotide base pairs. And a way to explain that is that our genes, our DNA, are made up of four nucleotide base pairs, adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of it as letters of the alphabet. And you can have a gene mutation that's due to a misspelling of one of those letters. And while the microarray technology could get us down to a fairly refined level, it still couldn't pick up a misspelling in a single gene. And that's where we've used sequencing, traditionally various methodologies using PCR, Sanger sequencing, named after Dr. Sanger, who unfortunately passed away within the last week,
mm-hmm.
won two Nobel Prizes, right, in part for his development of Sanger sequencing. So that was really a way to look at the spelling of our genes. However, it could only look at a fairly small stretch of our DNA. And again, you'd really have to know specifically what gene to look at, what gene to sequence. And so that's where whole genome technology, or what's been termed next generation sequencing, has brought us to a whole new level in our ability to detect mutations in the human genome. Now, what we're using for our study is called whole exome sequencing. Exome meaning the exons of genes, which are really the working parts of a gene, not the only part that's important, but certainly a very critical part to what genes are supposed to do in many cases, and that's make proteins. And so the exons make up about 1% of our entire DNA, so a relatively small percentage, but again, a very critically important part. Some individuals, you know, are working on whole genome sequencing, and that probably will become more widely available. But for one thing, just the cost of it, mm-hmm. the ability to interpret the information that provides, we're not able to do that right now as part of our research study, but we will be looking at all of the exons in individuals who participate in the study.
So the whole exome sequencing, it's cheaper, faster, I assume actually easier, and yields a great deal of information.
Yes.
So that's kind of a good working method to use in studies like this.
Yes, exactly, and relatively inexpensive. We've estimated for our study that the actual cost of doing the sequencing is about $2,000 per research subject.
Mm-hmm. Which is coming down rapidly, too,
yes.
Is it not?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, Cindy, as I mentioned in the introduction, you and Dr. Berg will be co-principal investigators of the UNC arm of this large NIH grant. And we had hoped to have Dr. Berg on the show as well, but weren't able to schedule it, so we had to not settle, but just go with you today. And wanted to kind of get into an overview of this grant itself, because there's a lot going on in this large grant.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that it actually funds four different centers for particular purposes.
Yes, that's correct. So the NIH, realizing that this new technology was becoming more widely used, and also understanding the all of the different components of it, including the ethical, legal, social issues of it, were interested in having centers study this. One of the main areas was to just be able to utilize the information and track this information in terms of next generation sequencing and the huge amount of data that's produced, you know, from just, you know, sequencing one individual's genome. So that was a big part of it, being mm-hmm. able to handle large scale sequencing like this.
So big data issues.
Yes, big mm-hmm. data, exactly. Okay. And then another part was to look at the practical aspects. Is this something that, you know, could be utilized to expand our ability to screen for conditions in newborns and children? There's standard newborn screening now, which saves many lives. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary in the U.S. of newborn screening.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes conditions such as PKU, or phenylketonuria, which is a condition that you'd never know an infant had when they're born. But if they're not rapidly diagnosed and placed on a very special diet, they can suffer extreme brain damage and end up with developmental disabilities. And so that was really the first condition that we started screening for in the U.S. It's expanded greatly over the years and is a very successful program. But there are many conditions that would be beneficial to detect early on in children, but for which there's no testing available, at least no testing that could be done on a widespread public health basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why NIH was interested in looking at whether whole exome or whole genome sequencing could be utilized to detect some of those conditions. And then another part of the study, as I said, is to look at the ethical issues involved with it, because in addition to finding conditions that you can treat in the standard sense, such as PKU, for example, there are conditions that we would theoretically be able to detect that there wouldn't be any treatment in the standard sense. However, you could look at whether it would be beneficial to identify it in a child, not only for their benefit, but possibly for other family members, the parents, for example.
Sure.
But then there's also conditions that probably you don't want to give that information. You know, a lot of, for example, adult onset conditions for which there's no treatment for even in adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And so a large part of our study will be looking at what genetic information we can give the family, what is important to give because we can intervene, and conditions that we term medically actionable. And then what are some genes that might be beneficial to know about, maybe not in childhood, but later on? And should parents, you know, have the option of getting that information if they want it? And then what are the genes that we just shouldn't report back, for which, you know, at least at this point in this day and age, we have no treatment for, mm-hmm. and which, you know, children may not want to know about when they're older. And thinking about the ethics of genetic testing in children, that's something that many people have thought about, written about, discussed over the years. One of the things that we have to be very careful of is if you do a genetic test in a child, it takes away their right not to know that information when they're old enough to, you know, decide for themselves. Sure. Maybe they don't want to know if they're going to be at risk for developing, you know, a neurological problem, for example, that at mm-hmm. least at this point isn't treatable. So those are the things that we're spending a lot of time and effort looking at. Dr. Berg and others have done a lot of pre-work in that area in terms of thinking about these genes. And we go through a process that they've termed binning. So basically putting genes in different bins according to the medical actionability, the onset age, for example, the ability to offer treatment or screening things to patients, such as if you were predisposed to having a cancer, for example. Is there a good way of screening for it? Could you do something early, you know, to prevent cancer from developing, mm-hmm. Such as some of the conditions that lead to colon cancer? There's a genetic condition called Lynch syndrome that people are at a very high risk of developing cancerous polyps and tumors in the colon. And through early detection, people can have colonoscopies. Those precancerous growths can be removed, and you can prevent cancer in those individuals.
Sure.
So we're looking at, you know, what genes sort of fit into that category. Mm-hmm. And then kind of what we've called bin X in terms of, let's say, Alzheimer's disease. Currently, there's no treatment for it. Hopefully that will change, you know, in the near future. People are certainly, you know, studying that a lot. NIH also has an effort to increase, you know, the amount of research in that area. But right now we know that there's nothing we can do about it. So, you know, we feel that there are genes like that that we don't even want to give parents the ability to decide to know about.
And I know individuals, adults, have some issues about whether they can or should be told about those types of genes.
Yes.
Those types of mutations.
Yes. Correct. So in another study that we're doing, we're looking at, you know, the use of whole exome sequencing in adults and, you know, looking at how they decide what information they do or don't want to know about.
Well, it certainly sounds like you've opened up multiple cans of worms with all of this and some really interesting and but thorny ethical and social and legal issues, which I do want to get into. But coming back specifically to the UNC arm of the study, I understand that you're sequencing the exomes of these 400 newborns. Is it evenly divided between healthy infants and infants with known conditions?
Yes. So we have one cohort of infants and children with known conditions. 200 will be in that group.
Okay.
Those will include children who have been identified with conditions through standard newborn screening, mm-hmm. such as PKU. There's another condition called MCAD. It's a biochemical disorder that causes blood glucose levels to go very low during periods of fasting. It can be easily treated with frequent feedings, but one that is, you know, part of the standard newborn screening because it is so important to know about, and, you know, deaths can be prevented, you know, by diagnosing it early.
Mm-hmm.
There'll also be children with cystic fibrosis, another condition that's screened for nowadays in North Carolina. and other conditions like that that are picked up already with standard newborn screening. So we're interested to see, will this new technology be as sensitive as standard newborn screening and even diagnosing conditions like this?
So it's in a sense validating that practice.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then we'll also look at some conditions which have been suggested to be included with newborn screening, but for which there's not really good methodologies to diagnose them at this point. Some of the what are called lysosomal storage diseases that cause brain damage, and many of those are now treatable through various techniques, giving that missing enzyme, bone marrow transplants, for example. Mm-hmm. So we'll include some children with conditions like that and other rare conditions just to see if, you know, we can detect them through this whole exome sequencing.
I see. So ultimately leading potentially to adding to the newborn screening that's out there in the public.
Yes, okay. Correct. Well, I mean, the cost will definitely need to come down before you can use it, you know, public health-wide, but, you know, hopefully that will be available within the next, you know, decade or so.
And what is the purpose of screening the healthy newborns?
So we wanted to have a group that would really represent the typical newborn who undergoes newborn screening. The vast majority of newborns who have newborn screening comes back normal. And we really don't expect to pick up anything in that group of 200. Mm-hmm. The mothers of those children and fathers will be recruited during the pregnancy, and they'll go through a very detailed consent process. They'll be able to have what we call informed decision making to decide whether or not they want to participate in the study. And then they'll be randomized into different groups in terms of what information they'll be able to get if, you know, they decide to participate and their newborn's whole exome is sequenced.
I see. Well, I understand that one of the major goals, and you've already kind of touched on it, is to help identify best practices in returning results to the patients or to participants, I should say, and
yes.
Not really patients, both parents and the physicians. And I understand that that's really at the heart of your portion of the study. Cindy, you've already published several papers in this area looking at your bibliography, focusing on the issue of what are known as incidental findings. That's a terribly thorny ethical issue. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't agree with that term, incidental findings. These are genetic changes that one finds through doing whole exome or whole genome sequencing that really was not the initial intent of the test.
Mm-hmm.
Whole exome sequencing is being offered on a clinical basis now. Physicians can order the testing on their patients and it can be sent for this type of testing. For example, often it's used in children who have conditions that appear to be genetic, but for which all of the standard testing didn't detect any specific change, so there's no diagnosis yet. And this is a way to look at theoretically all 20,000 human genes. Studies have shown that about 25% of children in this category, and adults as well in this category, will have changes detected through the use of whole exome sequencing. Paper was published in the last month in the New England Journal of Medicine by a group at Baylor College of Medicine that showed a 25%, so to speak, hit rate, you know, mm-hmm. finding a diagnosis with use of this new technology. So we're, interested in looking at those specific genes. However, when you do whole exome, you'll also find changes in other genes. And my colleague, Dr. Berg and also Dr. Evans at UNC have published quite a bit. And Dr. Berg was part of a group that was formed by the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics, the ACMG, that got together to look at these other genes for which information might be obtained through through whole exome sequencing, and which ones would be critical to report back to patients, even if they didn't intend to get that information initially, but which you know, would doctors need to be informed about by the labs that did the testing. And they came out with a list of 57 genes. They've taken one off their list, so it's now down to 56. But these are these medically actionable genes. So, for example, a gene for Lynch syndrome, or one of the genes for Lynch syndrome, okay, for which, you know, information would be very important to let a patient know about. Also, some genes that might cause serious heart problems, but again, for which intervention would be possible. And that's created quite a lot of controversy. people disagree, you know, with that anybody should be required to report back those results. That,
well, it seems like that's a real major step forward in the field, in that if you're going to have this done, you can know up front what that list of genes is going to be and decide based on, you know, real scientific evidence at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so, but a lot of ethicists and others around the country have disagreed. They feel that patients should have the option of getting that information, but basically it shouldn't be forced on them.
Sure.
And the same with, you know, a physician. And so I think a lot of the clinical labs offering this whole exome-wide testing are giving people the option of whether or not they want to have this information. Because I think one of the fears is that it might discourage people from undergoing testing that could benefit them for, you know, other reasons. Maybe they want to find out why their child, you know, is developmentally delayed, or an adult patient might want to find out why, you know, there's cancer running in their family, for example. But they might be very leery about this additional information, these quote incidental findings, and may shy away from the technology because of concern that, oh, we don't want to know this other information.
Mm-hmm. Can you illustrate this issue with some kind of hypothetical situations that might arise in the clinic with the adoption of these new tools?
Well, I think that, you know, for example, let's say in a pediatrics, because that's what I deal with most, in a child where we, you know, might suspect that there is an underlying genetic condition. And one of the next steps after that child undergoes, you know, standard testing, if the parents, you know, still want to find out, you know, what the cause of their child's problem is, a lot of parents in situations like that go on what's been termed a diagnostic odyssey, you know, searching for answers, going to multiple specialists, having their child, you know, undergo a lot of, you know, testing, genetic testing, other types of testing, sometimes, you know, biopsies and MRIs of the brain, things like that, just seeking a specific answer. Not only to find out is there something treatable that their child has, but also to know, you know, what are the risks for other children in their family? What's the risk of recurrence? What's the prognosis? You know, what does the future hold for their child? So, you know, if that family decides to, you know, have their child undergo whole exome sequencing, which from the child would typically, you know, just be a blood sample. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, they're given back information such as, you know, well, your child has a breast cancer gene. And so when your child is an adult, you know, they have a risk, probably about 80 to 85% lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. And again, you know, it raises the point that you're taking away that child's right not to have that information when they're older. Right. Also, you know, if there's a change sort of in how the family views that child, for example, you know, will it change kind of the whole family dynamics? That's a consequence, potential consequence. And really the same thing could be said for an adult. You know, maybe a woman who's had breast cancer, who, you know, has a family history of breast cancer and is trying to find out, you know, if she has one of the susceptibility genes for breast cancer, may undergo whole exome sequencing. And it may, you know, may or may not find a cancer-related gene that's, you know, associated with the problems in the family, but may also find out that she has a risk for a heart arrhythmia, for example, you know, so totally unexpected, something that may be, you know, treatable in terms of you could implant a defibrillator into the heart, but sort of takes her on a whole other journey that she hasn't otherwise expected to go on as a result of all this information that's given.
Sure, and a situation that's been highly illustrative recently was the Angelina Jolie incident. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm.
And I was reading an article just today about the situation with Ashkenazi Jews, and the women particularly being susceptible to having those breast cancer mutations.
Yes, there are some specific mutations in the breast cancer genes, BRCA1 and 2, that are more commonly seen in individuals of Ashkenazi Jewish background.
Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating and coming quickly to the clinic near you. I'm sure some of these technologies, as they do proliferate and as some of these techniques and tools and methods are perfected by folks like you. So you're performing a very valuable public health service. It's wonderful.
Well, we hope so. You know, certainly the physicians, you know, our creed is primum non nocere, so first do no harm. So we definitely want to make sure that we're using this technology to benefit patients and not to harm anybody. And that's why I'm certainly, you know, very grateful to NIH for funding our program, mm-hmm. but also, you know, see the importance of doing this on a research basis. The other three centers around the country are all approaching it a little bit differently in, you know, their studies. But I think we're all very cognizant of, you know, being very careful about the ethical issues. You know, NIH, I think, wanted to make sure that before this really got into mass use in the future, either on a direct-to-consumer basis or, you know, just other clinical applicability of whole exome sequencing, that, you know, we did study the ethical issues very carefully. And I should say that we're also subcontracting with RTI.
I was just about to ask you about that partnership. Yes.
Yes. And Dr. Don Bailey is the PI for that ELSI part of the study.
Mm-hmm. That being ethical, legal, and social implications.
Yes, exactly.
For
those who don't know about ELSI, yeah.
And, it's not the cow.
Right. And Don was the previous director of the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute, part of UNC. Mm-hmm. And then he's been with RTI for several years now. And he and I and others worked together on a project looking at newborn screening for Fragile X syndrome, which is a condition that can affect typically males more often than females, but it does cause developmental disability. And it's genetic in that once a person has one child with Fragile X, they're at risk of having additional children with Fragile X. And so we carried out a long-term study on looking at doing this testing in newborns. So Don has a lot of experience in that area. Mm-hmm. And then Dr. Chris Reaney from the UNC School of Public Health is Myra Roche, a genetic counselor. And Don and Megan Lewis, who's another researcher at RTI, are heading up the ELSI component of our project.
And what types of tools will they be looking to develop, and what gaps are they designed to fill?
They have a very strong background in developing decision aids for people who participate in research projects. They developed an excellent brochure that we utilized in our Fragile X newborn screening project. I think, you know, a lot of people, when they're given consent forms for research studies, you know, they're often handed it maybe by, you know, a physician or other healthcare provider or a you know, research coordinator, and they really don't, you know, take time to read it over. It's complicated. They can't understand it. Mm-hmm. And they may not realize all the different implications. And certainly for this project, we want participants and, you know, parents of our participants to understand the issues that are involved with this. And if they decide, you know, not to participate, that's fine. But we just want them to really have a good understanding of everything. And so
the true sense of informed consent.
Yes. And so there will be these decision aid tools developed with RTI that will look at, you know, how best to get this information across to parents. Clearly, you can't explain every, you know, gene that we might find a change in.
Sure.
But giving them sort of a background in the different types of conditions, like the different bins that they, you know, will get information on, that they might get information about, you know, depending on how they're randomized, and then, you know, which conditions would we not give information about. And we hope to have that, you know, electronically, something that, you know, they could, you know, use a tablet, an electronic tablet to, you know, read through and possibly even take home with them and, mm-hmm. you know, really go through it carefully, but which will be, you know, at a level that, you know, most individuals can easily understand.
Well, that's wonderful. And these are certainly decisions that are not to be made lightly or quickly.
Yes.
Highly exactly. Informed consent may be the way to go. So how is the study progressing so far? I know it's only been a couple of months, but have you already started enrollment? And where are you at this point?
We have not started enrollment because the ELSI arm of this is so important. We're spending really most of the first year in deciding on the bins that are the genes will go into, so which genes will report back and which we won't. We've been doing this for another study that we've been involved with, but it's interesting to look at it from the aspect of children, doing the testing in children, because previously it had mainly been adults where, you know, a lot of the incidental findings, you know, were discussed and thought about. So we're really spending a lot of time. We have what we call our binning committee, which is a group of healthcare providers, researchers, physicians, both adult, pediatric, doctors, genetic counselors, and others who are involved in where we, you know, meet and go over various genes. We look at how much information is known about a gene, what's the likelihood that it will cause a problem if a person has a mutation in that gene. Are there ways that we can screen people? Can we avoid them, you know, having a disease as a result of having a change in that gene? Is there mm-hmm. intervention available?
Sure.
And so issues like that we're looking at. It's fascinating just to hear the discussions, you know, that go around the table in thinking about different genes. Mm. For example, you know, there are some genes that might cause sudden death, let's say an arrhythmia, cardiac arrhythmia. how do you weight that compared to a gene that might cause lifelong developmental disability? And so that's brought up a lot of discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, it's different when you might find that gene in an adult who's otherwise fine. But what about in a child where you don't know what the future might hold for them?
Sure.
So you really have to think about it in a unique way for the pediatric population.
And I'm sure part of the challenge of those kind of discussions also is, you know, the fact that with some exceptions, generally you're talking about risks. And not a sealed fate, as with a single gene disease, such as cystic fibrosis or something like that, where you can really make a pretty definitive prediction.
Yes.
You know, this is you have a 20% elevated risk of such and such when you're age 50.
Exactly. And another big challenge is knowing what gene alterations really mean. Our DNA is very different. I mean, we all have variations in those letters of the alphabet at different places. Mm-hmm. Some of those changes are associated with a disease process, but others are not. We have a lot of, you know, benign variability in our genomes. And, you know, one of the major challenges from use of whole exome and whole genome sequencing is figuring out, are these changes significant or not? Members of our research team will spend a lot of time trying to sort through those genetic changes. Are they truly deleterious mutations, or are they just benign variants?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole complexity of whole exome sequencing, I think, hasn't really taken into account how difficult it is to sort through that information. The sequencing itself is relatively easy.
Sure.
but it's really the interpretation that is so laborious, time-consuming, you know, can take hours. You have to research, you know, is there anything known about this mutation? What does this mutation do? You look at it through evolution, you know, look at other species. Is that, you know, specific sequence something that has been maintained throughout evolution, in which case an alteration more likely is significant, but not always? Does it change that protein product of the gene? All of those things. So we utilize, you know, all available databases. Dr. Berg recently got funding for another very exciting project that will help with expanding the database in terms of, you know, what mutations are significant and what are just, you know, benign variants. So that's a very important part of you know, the process that we're going through as well.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to mention, in terms of thinking about the binning of genes and return of results to patients, we not only have our own group, our own binning committee, but Dr. Bailey and the group at RTI will be sending out questionnaires to other professionals, groups of physicians, pediatricians, obstetricians, gynecologists, genetic counselors, medical geneticists, to get their opinions about this. And then also they will have focus groups of made up of parents to find out, you know, what are their opinions? How do they think about, you know, these genes? And also they'll bring in a group of outside experts, people who have experience in newborn screening, others who are bioethicists, and so they'll be able to weigh in on their opinions. And I think that'll be one of the really fascinating things, is to see, you know, do people, can they come to an agreement about these things? I think parents may view things very differently than what a clinical geneticist, you know, might think about things. So we're getting feedback from many different individuals who are, you know, important to hear from in this.
And another aspect we haven't touched on yet, but that I know is emphasized in the study, is the importance of including multicultural families. Can you tell us what's so important about that?
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, over the years, many studies have had a bit of a bias in that, you know, Caucasians, maybe upper income level or middle income level people, were more likely to participate in studies. We know that we want to have cultural diversity. We're fortunate at UNC in our own patient population. We have a wide variety of patients from various ethnicities. And so we will include African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans in this study because, you know, these are our patient population. You know, we follow these children from birth, treating them for conditions, you know, that have been picked up through newborn screening. And also we have a good deal of diversity in our delivery area there in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So we hope to be able to recruit a good variety, because certainly it's important to consider how all individuals, all families, you know, think about this, and not just a select group. So that will be something that we will work very hard to do.
That sounds good. Sounds like you've got all the bases covered at this point. That's terrific. Cindy, can you envision a day when it will be just totally accepted and totally routine to sequence a newborn infant's DNA, whether it's whole exome or perhaps whole genome at some point as the costs continue to fall? Or is that path fraught with challenges that we may never fully overcome?
I think eventually it will happen. I'm not sure how quickly. Part of that will depend on the cost. We've made so many strides in technology in just the last few years that I suspect it won't be very long before cheaper methods are developed. I think we'll eventually work out all of the significance of genetic changes. We'll know whether, you know, a change is significant or not. We'll work out the ethical issues involved. And I really think that this will be just one more arm of our ability to improve public health, that if we, you know, can find things that children are susceptible for, whether it be, you know, cancers, developmental problems, and things that will may not occur until adulthood, but which are important to know about early on. Mm-hmm. So I really think that within the next decade, you know, we'll see that happen.
Really, that soon?
I think so.
Wow, that's interesting. Do you think the technology will progress to the point that quickly that where concerns about false positives and false negatives will kind of fall by the wayside?
I think with utilizing these databases, if we, you know, are able to sequence enough individuals, you know, there's the 1,000 genome database that you can look at now, and now they hope to, you know, go to 10,000, 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. So the more people we do that on, we'll have a better understanding of what's just, you know, normal variation and what's significant, you know, what's a severe harmful mutation. And so, you know, that's projects are underway already to do that. Sharing of information is certainly critically important because, you know, there's no point in just one center sequencing people, you know, and hanging on to their information. You know, it's all got to be shared. So that's going to be very important going forward.
And bioinformatics has to get caught up too, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. What to do with all this information. We're very fortunate here. We've got our RENCI group that have experience in this technology of data keeping and data interpretation. They've formulated, you know, really helpful databases already that, you know, we'll be expanding upon. Also very important is the confidentiality aspect, so that the research arm of this is totally separate from any, you know, medical information on a particular patient. Mm-hmm. So we will be very careful about, you know, keeping that all separate. And thanks to the group that we have in place, we're able to do that.
That's great. In fact, I was going to ask you about the privacy issue, even involved mm-hmm. with this particular study, because there's been so much publicity fairly recently about, you know, it's that it's becoming more and more difficult to truly anonymize these data.
Yes. One thing that we'll do is before we report back any information to our research subjects, we will confirm our findings in what we call a CLIA-approved lab, so a standard clinical hospital molecular laboratory, because it may not be verifiable. You know, we may have found something through whole exome that, you know, we can't confirm. That's not unusual. You know, that does happen.
Sure.
So we'll make sure, just as with any, you know, genetic test that a doctor orders, that a lab that's certified, you know, nationally has the capability to correctly confirm it, interpret it. They'll issue a report, and then that report would go into the patient's medical record. Again, that's something that they'll know about up front. If they don't want that information put into the medical record, they don't have to participate in the research project.
Indeed. Okay, well, you have that base well covered then. Very good. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Cynthia Powell, and she is a professor of pediatrics and genetics at the UNC School of Medicine and a clinical physician at the North Carolina Children's Hospital. We shouldn't let any more time pass without making sure people know that you are active in the clinic.
Yes, that's right. I spend a good deal of my time seeing patients both in the outpatient clinic and on our inpatient service with genetic conditions or birth defects, developmental disabilities. We see, you know, many patients with autism. Mm-hmm. They are referred to us with the question of, you know, is this problem genetic or not? We know that a significant number of children have problems due to genetic changes. And I think as a clinician, one of the frustrating things is that often we're not able to come up with an answer. We don't find, you know, a specific diagnosis.
Sure.
And the family then continues on their diagnostic odyssey, you know, trying to get an answer. So we're, you know, very excited about this new technology. It is expensive now, and I must say that I have not ordered it yet on any of my patients on a clinical basis,
mm-hmm.
but look forward to, you know, more wide use of it and the cost coming down so that we really can use it in the clinic. And, you know, again, another part of this project is to look at the clinical applicability of whole exome sequencing. So I'm excited about that.
Well, Cindy, we're actually almost out of time, but before we run out of our time together, I did want to ask you about something slightly different, as I mentioned to you previously. And this is another area that you've apparently done some research in and that I find quite fascinating, and that's not newborn DNA testing, but fetal DNA testing. How does that type of screening differ from the newborn screening we've been discussing? It's not actually necessarily even sequencing as such, is it?
Correct. So we've traditionally been able to offer prenatal genetic testing through typically invasive methods.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some screening that could be done, you know, by just sampling a mother's blood, but, you know, we'd have to do an invasive amniocentesis, taking amniotic fluid with a needle from, you know, the sac that surrounds the developing fetus to look for things like chromosome changes and genetic changes. In the last year or two, there's become widespread use of something called non-invasive prenatal testing. And this is a method whereby just a blood sample from the mother could be taken, and there's fetal DNA, so DNA that's come from the fetus that can be tested. Right now, it's mainly being done to look for chromosome changes, like extra chromosomes, 21, 18, 13, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But people are starting to use it to look for single gene mutations. It's not been used yet to do whole exome sequencing. I think people are starting to try it on a research basis. It's theoretically going to be possible.
Okay.
And as you said, raises a whole new set of ethical issues in
Indeed.
testing the unborn.
Yeah, because you could get into some selection issues there, couldn't you?
certainly, you know, now most conditions that are tested for would, you know, cause serious problems. But as we learn more about what other, you know, genes control things like, you know, traits, athletic abilities, all, you know, most of the common conditions like diabetes, heart disease, they're not due to single gene changes. They're multifactorial.
Sure.
And, you know, a lot of that information has not even been discovered yet. But as we do learn more about it, theoretically, you know, we'll be able to detect things like that through that technology.
I sense some funding in the future for you on some of those issues.
Possibly, yeah.
Well, do you, Cindy, do you see that technology as ultimately replacing amniocentesis altogether?
It may. You know, I think there's still, you know, it's not as sensitive. There's a lot more that we can pick up through standard amniocentesis that we can't detect yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely, you know, improving by the month, I would say. And it will be soon that we will be able to, you know, detect more and more through just taking a sample of blood from the mother. One of the concerns with doing invasive testing is that although it's a small risk, but it does increase the risk of fetal loss, having a miscarriage, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will sort of bypass that problem.
Is it already widespread in clinical use? Has it become kind of the new gold standard in amniocentesis, a kind of second level of care?
We're definitely getting fewer amnios in our lab, our cytogenetics lab.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that our prenatal genetics group is sending out more and more of this, what they call NIPT, the non-invasive prenatal testing, which is the blood test. So yes, it's coming into very common clinical use already.
I see. I wanted to ask you about one more thing to be sure that we cover most of what you're up to. And that's, you've done a lot of research on the genetic causes of hearing loss. Could you briefly summarize that for us?
Yes. So another type of newborn screening that's done in almost every state now, including North Carolina, is to do hearing tests on all newborns, because detecting hearing loss at an early stage is very important. Children can, you know, get hearing aids earlier. Some of them undergo cochlear implants at an early age. Their speech development is much better, and so this is an important area. However, we just screen for whether or not the hearing is normal or abnormal. There are many, many different causes of hearing loss that include genetic causes, environmental, infectious causes. A lot is still unknown. And so one of the things that I'm interested in is seeing how the whole exome sequencing may help us narrow down the specific cause of a child's hearing loss when it's been detected through newborn screening. So that's also a group in our cohort of children who already have known conditions that we'll be looking at. Parents are often frightened that their child has a hearing loss syndrome. There are some syndromes that not only cause hearing loss, but can cause vision loss, heart problems, other medical problems. So if we can help, you know, pinpoint the direct cause of the hearing losses at an early stage, I think it will lessen anxiety for a lot of parents, and it will also help us take care of those children better in case there are other things that we should be watching for as they get older.
Terrific. Well, Cindy, thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us on Radio In Vivo today, and best of luck to you and Dr. Berg as you move forward with this very important study.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check out the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And we are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. And we invite you to subscribe to our series of podcasts on iTunes. It's a handy way to keep up with new episodes. So join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Catch you next time. Thanks for listening.